From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
This case was both mentally challenging and emotionally exhausting. Deep thought and consideration has gone into our deliberations and the decisions that we reached.
John Lee Boyd will spend the rest of his life in prison, but he was spared the death penalty. Today, we'll talk about the juvenile death penalty. Then there's a mad cow in Washington. We'll talk with John Stauber, author of Mad Cow USA. We'll also be taking on some sacred cows, the overspent American shopping in the United States. Newly declassified documents show exactly what Donald Rumsfeld said to Saddam Hussein 20 years ago when he shook his hand. Other documents also indicate Bechtel's activities.
The corporate roots of U.S. Iraqi policy have been exposed like never before. In a 1988 cable, Bechtel threatened to take its business outside the United States if President Reagan signed an anti-genocide bill that would have halted Bechtel's dealings with Baghdad.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A cow slaughtered in Washington State earlier this month tested positive for BSE, better known as mad cow disease. Agriculture Department officials have announced the discovery marks the first time the dreaded illness has been detected in the United States. Meat from the infected animal traveled through three separate processing plants before a test revealed the problem 13 days later. Japan, the largest foreign customer for U.S. beef, announced a temporary halt to U.S. beef imports. South Korea, Singapore, Thailand, Malaysia, Taiwan, Hong Kong, and Russia have also barred beef imports. A jury yesterday rejected the death penalty for sniper Lee Boyd Malvo, sentencing him instead to life in prison without parole for a spree of random attacks that killed 10 people in the Washington, D.C. area last year. Defense lawyers argued that in deciding the sentence, Malvo's youth should be taken into account. He was just 17 at the time of the shootings. Prosecutor Robert Horan said Malvo, quote, is very lucky that he looks a lot younger than he is. We'll have more on both these stories later in the program. The Wall Street Journal is reporting President Bush is the least pardon-friendly president on average of all time. So far in his term, Bush has pardoned only 11 people. He's also pardoned five Thanksgiving turkeys. At this point in their terms, Bill Clinton had pardoned 56 people and George Bush Sr. 39. An internal White House advisory board has determined that President Bush made a questionable claim when he talked up Saddam Hussein's efforts to obtain nuclear materials in this year's State of the Union address, this according to the Washington Post. The Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board, chaired by former National Security Advisor Brent Scowcroft, found there was no, quote, deliberate effort to fabricate claims that Saddam tried to buy uranium from Niger. Yet the board found the White House was so anxious to, quote, grab onto something affirmative about Iraq's WMD program that it disregarded warnings that the claim was questionable. This news from Iraq, a truck bomb blast has killed at least four people and injured 20 in the northern Kurdish city of Erbil. In Baghdad, U.S. helicopter gunships backed an artillery bombardment as troops raided homes and arrested a Sunni sheikh said to be close to former Vice President Izzat Ibrahim al-Duri. Meanwhile, the Boston Globe is reporting that the U.S. may not be able to reduce the number of troops in Iraq from 130,000 to 100,000 as planned next year. In a 16-page report obtained by the Boston Globe, the White House cited, quote, the necessity of the full accomplishment of our goals in Iraq. Saudi Arabia has said it will not discuss any loan write-offs with Iraq's U.S.-appointed Iraqi Governing Council. This according to Al Jazeera. Foreign Minister Prince Saud al-Faisal said his country would wait until Iraq had an independent government before looking into possibly reducing the debt. France, Germany, and Russia have all recently agreed to forgive billions in Iraqi debt. The U.S. is still considering forgiveness. James Baker, who has traveled the world trying to get countries to forgive Iraq's debt, his law firm in Texas, Baker Botts, has been representing the Saudi government, the government that is refusing to forgive debt. The government is taking numerous security measures in response to the Department of Homeland Security's so-called elevated terror threat alert. Surface-to-air missiles are being deployed around Washington. State troopers are authorized to ride New York commuter trains. And Los Angeles International Airport is prohibiting curbside drop-offs or check-ins, requiring passengers to unload at the airport's parking garages. And the Washington Post is reporting a small number of foreign flight crews have been questioned in recent weeks after their names appeared to be similar to those on the FBI's terror watch list. Officials declined to identify the air carriers involved. In campaign news, Democratic presidential hopeful Senator John Kerry took out a $6.4 million loan against his house in Boston in an effort to finance his campaign in the early presidential primaries. In California, Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger has declared a state of emergency following the most powerful earthquake to hit the state in 4 years. Former Illinois Governor George Ryan pleaded not guilty yesterday to corruption charges and accused the federal government of conducting an investigation that tore his life apart. This past January, Ryan dealt the sharpest blow to the death penalty in 30 years by granting clemency to 167 prisoners on death row. And comedian Lenny Bruce has been granted a posthumous pardon by the state of New York 40 years after he was convicted in an obscenity case. Bruce was charged after a performance in 1964, during which he was said to have used more than 100 obscene words. We'll have more on this later in the program.
Fat and docile, big and dumb. They look so stupid, they aren't much fun. Cows aren't fun. They eat to grow, grow to die, die to be ate at the hamburger fry. Cows well done. Nobody thunk it, nobody knew. No one imagined the great cow guru. Cows are one. He hid in the forest, read books with great zeal. He loved Che Guevara, a revolutionary veal. Cow say tongue. He spoke about justice, but nobody stirred. He felt like an outcast, alone in the herd. Cow doll drums. He moved, we must fight, escape or we'll die. Cows gathered around, cause the stakes were so high. Bad cow pun. But then he was captured, stuffed into a crate, loaded onto a truck where he rode to his fate. Cows are bummed. He was a scrawny calf who looked rather woozy. No one suspected he was packing an Uzi. Cows with guns. They came with a needle to stick in his thigh. He kicked for the groin. He pissed in their eye. Cow well hung. Knocked over a tractor and ran for the door. 6 gallons of gas flowed out on the floor. Run, cows, run. He picked up a bullhorn and jumped up.
Cows with guns. Dana Lyons here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Although the United States Department of Agriculture insisted the U.S. beef supply is safe after announcing the first documented case of mad cow disease in the United States, the agency for 6 months repeatedly refused to release its tests for mad cow to United Press International. The USDA claims to have tested approximately 20,000 cows for the disease in 2002 and 2003, but has been unable to provide any documentation in support of this to UPI, which first requested the information in July. In addition, former USDA veterinarians tell UPI they have long suspected the disease was in U.S. herds and there are probably additional infected animals. USDA Secretary Ann Veneman announced late Tuesday during a hastily scheduled news briefing that a cow slaughtered December 9th on a farm in Mabton, Washington, had tested positive for mad cow disease. The farm has been quarantined, but the meat from the animal may have already passed into the human food supply. The slaughtered meat was sent for processing to Midway Meats in Washington, and the USDA is currently trying to trace if the meat went for human consumption. The fear is mad cow disease can infect humans and cause a brain-wasting condition known as variant of Creutzfeldt-Jakob's disease that is always fatal. More than 100 people contracted this disease in Britain after a widespread outbreak of mad cow disease in Britain in the 1980s. We turn now to John Stauber. He's founder of PR Watch and co-author of the book Mad Cow USA, Could the Nightmare Happen Here? Well, John, could it?
Well, Amy, it has and it is. Mad cow disease is now in the United States. To any of us who've been watching this train wreck happening over the last decade, this is not a surprise. The United States knew 15 years ago, way back in 1988, that this disease was spread through the practice of animal cannibalism, taking slaughterhouse waste that's unfit for human consumption and turning it into fat and protein supplements and feeding it back to livestock. In 1988, a few years after this disease was first observed in Britain, epidemiologists showed that that was the problem. In 1990, USDA officials were saying inside the USDA internally to each other that the U.S. should do what Britain had begun to do, which is to ban this practice of feeding rendered byproduct as animal feed. But they made the decision not to do it to protect the huge livestock industry in the U.S. from the expense of doing it. So here we are now a decade and a half later, and we have mad cow disease in the U.S. And even now, what we're seeing is a massive public relations campaign to tell the American people, this is no big deal. Don't worry. Our country is different. We don't have to do what Britain and Germany and France and Japan and all the other countries have done. We don't have to stop this cannibal feeding practice. We don't have to test meat before it's consumed. Everyone, go home. There's no problem here. It's just the fear-mongers who are trying to create a problem.
Can you explain the science, John? How does it affect the cow? How does it affect human beings?
Well, I can explain the science, even though I'm not a scientist. It's actually pretty straightforward. Mad cow disease, or the human version of mad cow disease, or scrapie in sheep, or chronic wasting disease in deer and elk are all a family of diseases called transmissible spongiform encephalopathies, or TSEs. It's a very bizarre family of diseases. The best way to explain it is to refer to them as prion diseases. Prion, P-R-I-O-N, is a term invented by Dr. Stanley Prusner of the University of California, San Francisco, who in 1997 won the Nobel Prize for his work in this area. What we know about prion diseases is that they can be spread through the consumption of infected material. In the early part and mid part of the 20th century in New Guinea, the Foray tribe was decimated by a prion disease called Kuru, that was investigated and found to be spread through a funeral ritual involving cannibalism. So when mad cow disease appeared in Britain in 1985, British officials immediately said internally to themselves, this could be bad news because this is a disease we've seen in sheep. We've never seen it in cattle, but we've seen something similar in people, kuru. Maybe people who eat British beef are going to get this disease. Rather than saying that to the public, they did what the U.S. Department of Agriculture is doing now. The British said, oh, don't worry, this is no big deal. Unfortunately, it became a huge deal. Hundreds of thousands of infected animals in Britain, over a million animals destroyed. And despite that, in 1996, the first cases of human mad cow disease. So we've only seen mad cow disease moving into people over the last 7 years. The number of deaths now is up over 100 in Britain and around the world. So that sounds like a small number. Why are we so worried? Well, we're worried because there's a long invisible incubation period with this disease. In humans, the incubation period might be anywhere from 5 to 40 years. And just this week, Nature magazine and others reported what appears to be the first case of a human dying from mad cow disease who actually contracted the disease through a blood transfusion, because we know that some people in Britain exposed to mad cow disease and who came down with human mad cow disease gave blood, and it looks like blood may be able to spread this type of disease. Now, just one more point. Here in the United States, we feed billions of pounds of slaughtered byproduct, the slaughterhouse waste unfit for human consumption, back to livestock animals every year. Back in the summer of 1997, the Food and Drug Administration announced what has been referred to as a ban on this practice. It was not a ban. The U.S. government and the meat industry was being extremely disingenuous at the time. What they said is that meat and bone meal from ruminant animals, cows and sheep, for instance, is supposed to be labeled, "Do not feed to ruminants." Well, we know now that this regulation has been widely ignored and that that feeding has gone on. But even if the regulation had been strictly enforced, it was completely inadequate because meat and bone meal, slaughterhouse waste from cattle can continue to be fed and is fed to pigs, pets, and poultry. Those species, their carcasses and remains can be ground up and fed back to cattle and fed back to themselves. And regarding cattle, in the United States, fat and blood were exempted from the 1997 ruminant feeding ban. So we have a situation here in the U.S. where we are literally weaning calves on raw bovine cattle blood plasma that's put in their milk formula as a protein source. We're weaning calves on cattle blood protein, even though, as I said, there's plenty of evidence that blood plasma can spread this type of disease. So here in the United States, rather than doing what needs to be done, and it's rather simple since the United Kingdom and Germany and Italy and Japan have all done the right thing, rather than following their lead, imposing a rather complete ban on feeding any slaughterhouse waste back to animals and testing virtually every animal before consumption, we're going ahead continuing these feeding practices, and now the U.S. government and industry are engaged in a massive campaign to tell the American people, don't worry, it's no big deal.
John Stauber, author of Mad Cow USA. He is also author of the new book, Weapons of Mass Deception. John, we've seen you interviewed a lot now in the mainstream media on your book on Mad Cow, though you haven't got quite as much attention on Weapons of Mass Deception. We're also joined on the phone by Howard Lyman. He is author of the book Mad Cowboy, Plain Truth from the Cattle Rancher Who Won't Eat Meat. He's the man who was on the Oprah Winfrey Show when she said she wouldn't eat hamburgers anymore and then was sued by the Texas Cattlemen's Association and took her show to Texas to take on that lawsuit. She ultimately won. Howard Lyman, your reaction to the latest news about the mad cow in Washington?
Well, I think that the U.S. probably got the worst Christmas present that they could ever get. Right now, we're going to see, I think, an economic impact of the U.S. By countries cutting off our export of meat, which we have done for years being so self-righteous. Right now, we are going to see a economic disaster, and all of the time the administration and the industry are going to say, oh, we didn't do anything wrong. We built a strong firewall. Well, the firewall was a picket fence, and we are going now to get exactly what we gave other countries, which was to cut off the export of their meat. They're going to do the same thing to ours. The problem is one of the greatest economic returns to the U.S. is the export of our animal products. I think right now the economic recovery of this nation could well be stalled totally by what happened because of an industry that was unwilling to do what everyone in the industry knew should have been done, but they placed profits ahead of the consumer welfare. And so I think that the Christmas present to this nation and the industry is going to be not only a piece of coal in their shoe, it's going to end up to be a piece of granite. So I think it's the worst of all news for this country.
Howard Lyman and John Stauber talking about mad cow disease. We'll be back with them in a minute.
He picked up a bullhorn and jumped up on the hay. We are free-roving bovines. We run free today. We will fight for bovine freedom and hold our large heads high. We will run free with the buffalo or die. Cows with guns. Crashed the gate in a great stampede, tipped over milk truck, torched all the feed. Cows have fun. 60 police cars were piled in a heap, covered in cow pies, covered up deep. Much cow dung. Black smoke rising, darkening in the day, 12 burning McDonald's, have it your way. We will fight for bovine freedom and hold our large heads high. We will run free with the buffalo or die. Cows with guns. The president said, enough is enough. These uppity cattle, it's time to get tough.
Cows with guns. Dana Lyons here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Our guests are John Stauber, co-author of Mad Cow USA, and Howard Lyman, author of Mad Cowboy, Plain Truth from the Cattle Rancher Who Won't Eat Meat. We're going to turn for a minute to the hastily put together news conference yesterday of the Secretary of Agriculture, Ann Veneman.
I've been in contact with Secretary Ridge, and I would emphasize that based on the information available, this incident is not terrorist-related, nor is it related in any way to our nation's heightened alert status. I cannot stress this point strongly enough. The safety of our food supply and public health are high priorities of this administration and high priorities of USDA.
Ann Veneman, the Secretary of the Department of Agriculture. John Stauber, who is she?
Well, Ann Veneman is the Secretary of Agriculture right now. She's had an interesting career. She was very involved with Calgene, one of the early genetic engineering companies. She worked as a lobbyist for the big D.C. lobby firm of Patton Boggs. She's an attorney. She's a woman who's had a lot of bipartisan support. But if you look at her current position as Secretary of Agriculture, certainly it's one of the most powerful cabinet posts in the administration or any administration, because agribusiness is one of the two or three most powerful and most important economic sectors in the U.S. Of course, it's heavily subsidized. It's dominated by giant corporations. And when you look at the mad cow problem, a lot of people say, especially outside the United States where they get better information on this issue, what's the problem in America? Why don't they just do what Britain has done? Why don't they stop this practice of feeding slaughterhouse waste back to animals and test their cattle? It's interesting to see how Britain has come through this, how the European countries have come through this. There was great denial in those countries at first, too, but then they did the right thing. But here in the United States, the powerful agribusiness industries, the big beef conglomerates, the slaughterhouses and the rendering plants, are simply, as Howard Lyman said, greedy. And they do not want to stop feeding this waste product, slaughterhouse waste, fat and blood and grizzle and protein, back as feed supplement to livestock. And the U.S. Department of Agriculture, as I mentioned, has known for over a decade that this is the only thing that can be done to prevent mad cow disease. And their own internal documents that we report on in our book, Mad Cow USA, have observed that such a ban on byproduct feeding would be economically painful for the livestock industry, so they're not going to implement it. So I would say Ann Veneman, as Secretary of Agriculture, or any Secretary of Agriculture, isn't really primarily concerned about human and animal safety. What they're primarily concerned about is preserving the economic status quo for the massive agribusiness industry. And in the United States, in the production of livestock, and we're the biggest single livestock producing nation by far, that means taking slaughterhouse waste and feeding it back to animals and refusing to test animals adequately before they're slaughtered to determine whether mad cow disease is spreading through our livestock population. Now we know we have mad cow disease, and we've got the Secretary of Agriculture being disingenuous and saying things like, well, don't worry, it's not in meat, because meat is muscle. It's in the brain and the spinal cord and the nerve tissue. Well, the reality is, Amy, that if I were in the studio and I reached over and I pinched you really hard on your bicep, you'd probably feel some pain. That's because you have nerve tissue running through that muscle meat that we call your bicep. And the next day, you'd probably see a bruise there. That's because you have blood vessels running through that muscle meat we call your bicep. And blood and nerve tissue are infectious. Furthermore, there's some startling new research done by Stanley Prusiner, the Nobel laureate out of the University of California, that shows that in his genetically engineered test mice, he is finding infectious material in the muscle meat, and there's been follow-up research in Germany. So this idea that we don't have to worry because the muscle meat isn't infectious is just a huge myth that we're going to hear over and over and over as scientific fact in the days ahead.
Finally, Howard Lyman, we only have 30 seconds. Agriculture Secretary Ann Veneman says, quote, "I plan to serve beef for my holiday dinner." During Britain's mad cow disease crisis in 1990, then Agriculture Minister John Gummer gathered the media to witness him sharing a hamburger with his young daughter. With the Atkins diet craze in this country, the meat industry has boomed like never before. With beef, certainly, sales surging in this country. You took on the Cattlemen's Association. They sued you and Oprah Winfrey. What is the fallout of that?
Well, the fallout of it is that instead of a few million people knowing about it because of the show, over 200 million people found out about it due to the lawsuit. And so what I would say right now is the worst thing in the world that could happen to the industry is the spotlight is going to be shown on the inadequacies of our defense. And I think what we're going to see is the economic reversal of an industry that will be hard-pressed to recover in the future because of greed now rather than worrying about their consumers.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for being with us again. Howard Lyman has written the book Mad Cowboy, Plain Truth from the Cattle Rancher Who Won't Eat Meat, speaking to us from West Virginia. And John Stauber, he is the editor of PR Watch, and he is the co-author of Mad Cow USA. His latest book is Weapons of Mass Deception. You are listening to Democracy Now! As we turn now to our next issue. Newly declassified documents obtained by the nonprofit National Security Archive show that Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld went to Baghdad in December and March of 1984 with instructions to deliver a private message about weapons of mass destruction. The Washington Post reports the message was that Washington's public criticism of Iraq for using chemical weapons would not derail U.S. attempts to forge a better relationship. The 1984 visit was Rumsfeld's second visit to Iraq on behalf of President Ronald Reagan. Rumsfeld met with Saddam Hussein in Baghdad December 20th, 1983. Uncovered documents also reveal that construction firm Bechtel planned to evade economic sanctions imposed by Washington after Saddam Hussein used poison gas on Iraq's Kurdish minority. According to a 1988 confidential State Department cable, then U.S. Ambassador to Iraq April Glaspie wrote that Bechtel officials threatened then to use non-U.S. suppliers to sidestep the sanctions. In April of this year, Bechtel landed the largest U.S. Agency for International Development contract to date for infrastructure repair work in Iraq. The deal's worth an initial payment of $34.6 million and up to $680 million in total. Joining us now is Jim Vallette, Research Director for Sustainable Energy and Economy Network, known as SEEN, and author of Crude Vision, How Oil Interests Obscured U.S. Government Focus on Chemical Weapons Used by Saddam Hussein. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
Well, how surprised were you by these new documents, or newly uncovered documents?
Well, I think in terms of the 1984 Rumsfeld documents, it adds to the body of evidence that the National Security Archives has obtained and released out to the public, which shows the predominance of U.S. business interests in the formulation and implementation of U.S. policy and relations with Saddam Hussein, beginning with the Reagan administration's ascension to power in 1981. In that time, what the Washington Post did not really reflect was the economic background of Rumsfeld's visits with Saddam Hussein. These occurred simultaneous with an initiative by Bechtel to build a billion-dollar oil pipeline from Iraq to the Gulf of Aqaba in Jordan. That was really a driving force in U.S.-Iraqi relations. The Reagan administration dropped Iraq from the list of countries that support terrorism, despite plenty of evidence that that Saddam Hussein was involved in supporting, like, the Achille Lauro and plenty of other terrorist initiatives in the 1980s. So they dropped the terrorism designation, and that opened the way for U.S. Business and government relations with Saddam Hussein. The U.S. Export-Import Bank was poised to give Bechtel about $700 million in support of this pipeline project. the U.S. was sharing intelligence information, aerial photographs of Iranian troop movements, which Saddam Hussein used to deploy chemical weapons. That intelligence helped Saddam's troops figure out where the troops were and deployed chemical weapons, which Washington was well aware of. In 1988, that's when Chemical Ali gassed the Kurds of Halabja, and thousands died. A couple months later, Chemical Ali and Bechtel representatives sat down and inked a contract to build a $2 billion petrochemical plant.
Explain who Chemical Ali is.
He was the henchman who was in charge of the chemical weapons program for Saddam Hussein, and pulled the trigger on the Kurds in 1988. And Bechtel representatives turned around and signed a contract to build this $2 billion petrochemical plant just south of Baghdad. In that context, you had U.S. Senate action to halt U.S. business and political relations with Saddam Hussein. Claiborne Pell, Senator Pell, sponsored and got through the Senate this anti-genocide act, which would have halted export-import bank credits, agricultural credits, and even imports of oil from Iraq. In response, the extremely well-organized and influential U.S.-Iraq Business Forum pressured President Reagan not to sign the bill, as well as members of the House of Representatives. What this National Security Archives memorandum from April Glaspie, the ambassador, reveals is the extent to which Bechtel used threats to cajole and strong-arm Reagan into not supporting this important anti-genocide bill. Bechtel threatened to take its business overseas if this bill passed, and this is a threat that we see commonplace among the most inside of cronies. For example, in looking at Enron's global expansion, we saw that, like Bechtel, Enron operated hand in glove with Washington, and when it didn't get its way with Washington, threatened to take its business overseas. Enron was supported by over $7 billion in U.S. taxpayer finance. Bechtel's benefited from billions of dollars of fossil fuel financing by the U.S. government over the years. Halliburton rose to global prominence in the 1990s. Because Dick Cheney parlayed his connections to international henchmen into improved U.S. Relations and U.S. Economic packages of aid through the Export-Import Bank and Overseas Private Investment Corporation. So this one memorandum, which is available on National Security Archives' website from 1988, really reveals how companies like Bechtel have the bottom line as their priority and use national governments, like the United States, as kind of a shopping mall. And if they can't get what they want in one government, they'll take their business to another government. And in so doing, they've created a national foreign policy that is called constructive engagement, but is really destructive engagement. Halliburton worked with companies with countries like Burma, justifying their relations as constructive engagement. Dick Cheney, as CEO of Halliburton, tried to get the Iran-Libya Sanctions Act dropped so that Halliburton could get into those countries. And when they could not get the congressional approval or dropping of sanctions against these brutal countries, they did move their business overseas to European subcontractors.
Well, Jim Vallette, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Research Director for the Sustainable Energy and Economy Network and author of Crude Vision, How Oil Interests Obscured U.S. Government Focus on Chemical Weapons Use by Saddam Hussein. Just want to let people also know what's coming up tomorrow on Christmas Day and Friday on Democracy Now! Tomorrow is a special tribute to the blacklisted lyricist Yip Harburg, who put the rainbow in The Wizard of Oz. And on Friday, we'll hear one of the latest speeches of Noam Chomsky, who has just turned 75. Coming up, we'll look at the sentence for Lee Boyd Malvo, the young sniper in Washington. Then we will talk about Lenny Bruce and the pardon by the New York governor. You are listening to Democracy Now! Back in a minute.
It all began when they took me from my home and put me on death row. A crime for which I'm totally innocent, you know. I began to warm and chill to objects and their fields. A ragged cup, a twisted mop, the face of Jesus in my suit. Those sinister dinner deals, the meal trolley's wicked wheels. A hook bone rising from my food, and all things either good or ungood. And the mercy seat is waiting, and I think my head is burning, and in a way I'm yearning to be done with all this weighing of the truth. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, and anyway I told the truth, and I'm not afraid to die. I hear stories from the chamber. Christ was born into a manger, and like some ragged stranger, he died upon the cross. Might I say it seems so fitting, in its way he was a carpenter by trade, or at least that's what I'm told. My kill hand's tattooed evil across its brother's fist. That filthy five, they did nothing to challenge or resist. In heaven his throne is made of gold.
The late Johnny Cash, Mercy Seat, here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
Both mentally challenging and emotionally exhausting. Deep thought and consideration has gone into our deliberations and the decisions that we reached.
The lead juror yesterday rejecting the death penalty for sniper Lee Boyd Malvo. The jury sentenced him instead to life in prison without parole for a spree of random attacks that killed 10 people in the Washington, D.C. area last year. Defense lawyers argued in deciding the sentence Malvo's youth should be taken into account. He was just 17 at the time of the shootings. Prosecutor Robert Horan said, Malvo, quote, is very lucky he looks a lot younger than he is. Malvo was found guilty last week of capital murder and terrorism after he and his accomplice, John Allen Muhammad, demanded $10 million from the U.S. government to stop the killings. Both Malvo and Muhammad could still face trial over other shootings in Virginia and other states. If convicted, Malvo could still face the death penalty. We're joined on the phone now by David Elliott, Communications Director with the National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning, Amy.
Your reaction to this verdict and sentence for Lee Boyd Malvo?
We were very pleased with the verdict. We thought that it was appropriate. It obviously was a gut-wrenching and agonizing decision that the jury had to reach. Consider the fact that a jury in a conservative area of Virginia, after hearing weeks of testimony concerning this egregious crime, chose not to return a death sentence. This is just groundbreaking stuff, and we actually believe that it is going to be the beginning of the end of the death penalty for minors in the United States.
The family members who spoke out after court yesterday were not pleased with the fact that Lee Boyd Malvo was not sentenced to death. Let's take a listen.
I'm not at all pleased with the verdict. I think that he should have gotten the death penalty.
I don't think there could be another case that would be more deserving of the capital punishment.
There were two people who committed the ultimate crime. One got the ultimate penalty and one didn't. I ask you why.
Your response, David Elliott.
It's really tough on the victims. It's really tough, and, you know, our hearts go out to them. Consider if you're a victim and it's involving a death penalty case, consider what you're going to go through. If there is a death sentence that's returned, the appeals generally are going to last about 8 to 10 years. maybe a little bit quicker in Virginia, but not significantly so. And you're going to be subjected to the topsy-turvy roller coaster ride that represents the death penalty system in the U.S. Some days you're going to hear good news. Some days you're going to hear not so good news. So with the death penalty, you don't really have closure for the victims the same way that you do with the sentence of life without parole. We believe that down the line, the victims in the sniper case are going to be able to move on with their lives. They are going to be able to reach closure because of this sentence.
David Elliott, I want to thank you for being with us, Communications Director with the National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty, responding to the jury's rejection yesterday of the death penalty for Lee Boyd Malvo. He was 17 when he committed the crimes last year. You are listening to Democracy Now! As we move now to some unexpected news, a posthumous pardon by New York Governor George Pataki for comedian Lenny Bruce, 40 years after he was convicted in an obscenity case. Bruce was charged after a performance in 1964, during which he was said to have used more than 100 obscene words. Undercover police attending the show at Cafe Agogo in New York City counted the swear words he used and later testified against him. The groundbreaking 1960s comedian was convicted after a six-month trial, but died of a drug overdose in 1966 before serving any time. He was 37 years old. His conviction remained on the books until yesterday, when Governor Pataki issued the state's first posthumous pardon. Pataki called his decision, quote, a declaration of New York's commitment to upholding the First Amendment. This is a clip of the late Lenny Bruce speaking in 1963.
I found out that it's sort of masquerade time when you go into court, because the attorney will say, get a haircut and get a blue suit. Get a haircut and a blue suit and get rid of those shoes. And that's so the jurors or the triers of the facts are not confused. Hey there. Because that day in court, you know, they can pick out the felon, the one in the blue suit. Because that day, the man in blue is bereft of gun and badge. No bullets, he's got on the brown suit that day. Judge has got on his black robe, and it's masquerade time until the recess, and then the recess we have the... That's the time where the justice is really seen, because the felon gets a chance to view the magistrate in the natural. It's criminal to generalize. But subjectively, the police officers that I have known now, and politicians, all civil servants will say, they represent a point of view. They are a group. And in California, soon we will have a third party. I know that. There will be a police party. It's not a bad, a good, it's a what is. And it's a policeman that has his point of view. And like my father, he feels, just shut up and I'll take you.
And you are listening to Lenny Bruce. This is a clip from the Pacifica Archive from 1963. On the phone with us, David Scover, author of The Trials of Lenny Bruce, The Rise and Fall of an American Icon, a First Amendment expert and constitutional law professor at Seattle University Law School. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
It's good to have you with us. The Trials of Lenny Bruce, your book. Were you surprised by this pardon by Governor Pataki?
No, not surprised. Perhaps by the timing, we were told that the likelihood that the governor would pardon Lenny in December was slim. But we certainly were hopeful that the governor would do what we thought was just and necessary to correct a transgression, to correct this First Amendment violation that had existed for some 40 years.
Can you give us a brief biography of Lenny Bruce and his significance?
Well, Lenny was, without a doubt, the most controversial comedian of his day. I mean, there was no one in the late 50s or 1960s who was speaking his mind in comedy clubs about the subjects that Lenny Bruce decided to take on. I mean, Lenny Bruce came out of the Borscht Belt, the one-liner, the mother-in-law joke era, and Lenny had taken on the political establishment, the religious authorities, social conventions that he thought were either hypocritical or were oppressive, and he would diss the society's some of society's most cherished values about religion and sex and politics, and expose the underbelly. At one point, Time magazine called him a sicknick, meaning a sick comedian, a comedian who exposed the sickness of our society. So Lenny's role in comedy was to open it up to look seriously at the ills in the American social system, and to examine it through the lens of comedy. As I think most famous comedians know, the way to the audience's mind is often through the audience's belly laughs. And Lenny understood this as well. When the audience is laughing, it's accurate to say that when one is laughing, one is the most vulnerable. You're open, and an idea can slip through. Lenny understood that and exploited that with mastery. But of course, he did so on topics that really attacked the status quo values. And as he rose out of the strip club of Southern California into more mainstream clubs, the Crescendo, the Jazz Workshop in San Francisco, the Troubadour in L.A., as he began to rise into these larger, more mainstream clubs, the attention that was paid to him by the authorities became greater and greater. And that's where Lenny began to fall into trouble, because he was addressing mainstream audiences. The police would note in their arrest reports there were women present when he talked about sex, you know. As he became more famous, as he entered the mainstream in 59-60, that's when the heat came on.
In your book, The Trials of Lenny Bruce, you also talk about the Pacifica 1977 case, which actually is George Carlin, not Lenny Bruce. But how do they relate?
Well, Lenny Bruce opened up the comedy club as America's greatest free speech zone. From the day that Lenny Bruce died, there has never been another arrest for blue language in any comedy club in America. Now, George Carlin wasn't arrested for his language. Rather, the Pacifica Foundation, which owned the radio station in which George Carlin's Seven Dirty Words was played during drive time, was fined by the FCC. So the principle that case established is that although a comedian can say these words, in as Lenny Bruce did, in the nightclub before a live audience paying to hear him, the same language could not be used in drive time on the radio when children might be present to hear the same language. So there's the distinction between what happened, for example, to Lenny Bruce and what happened to George Carlin in 77.
David Scover, I want to thank you very much for being with us on this day after the New York governor, George Pataki, has posthumously pardoned comedian Lenny Bruce. You are listening to Democracy Now! In these last 2 minutes, we turn to Juliet Schorr. She is author of two books certainly relevant to today, The Overspent American, Why We Want What We Don't Need, and Do Americans Shop Too Much? In this Christmas Eve, when many people are racing out to figure how to fit in a few more buying of gifts in their schedule, your thoughts, Juliet Schorr, professor at Boston College.
Thank you, Amy. Well, the thing that comes most to mind today is the impact of the global economy on our consuming patterns and the fact that global competition, surpluses of labor around the world, abysmally low wages are fueling a consumer boom in this country with products that do not pay their ecological costs, do not pay even a bare subsistence wage to the workers who produce them in places like China and South Asia and Central America and so forth. So we've had an enormous growth in the volume of items that people are buying, whether it's the shift to what I call disposable apparel, very, very cheap apparel that people wear for a short period of time and then discard. Disposable consumer electronics, go on down the list. We are consuming at an unsustainable level. And certainly the day before Christmas is the ultimate day of that. Some estimates are that we'll up to 40% of the total holiday shopping is going to take place today.
What do you do on holiday eves like today?
Well, we have been trying, like a majority of Americans surveyed over recent years, to cut back to buy things which are made under sustainable conditions, both socially and ecologically, not to buy for the sake of buying, to buy things that will have lasting value, and to moderate our expectations.
Why do we want what we don't need?
It's a social process in which inequality, class inequality, fuels a kind of competitive dynamic in which people aspire to have what they don't have, in which we use consumer goods to signal our self-worth, our esteem. Social esteem comes from the kind of watch on our wrist or the car that we drive, how big our house is. And, you know, that's a sort of deep pathology in this culture, that the amount of money you have drives social esteem. But I think that's the core of it. And that process has intensified in recent years with the growth of inequality, very conspicuous consumption by the top 20% of the income distribution, and that has a trickle-down effect on everyone else in a kind of perverse way, because in a media-saturated culture where we're all watching what the affluent are doing, what's happening is that increasing numbers of Americans also want to live like them.
Well, Juliet Schorr, I want to thank you for being with us, professor of sociology, Boston College. Her book, The Overspent American. That does it for today's program. If you'd like to get a copy, call 1-800-881-2359, 1-800-881-2359. Our website is democracynow.org, and we are looking for a few good volunteers to help us with some heavy lifting and some answering of phone calls today, as well as Friday. You can give us a call at 212-431-9090, 212-431-9090. We're in Chinatown, just below Canal Street in New York City. That does it for the show, Democracy Now!, produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdul-Qudus, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Jeremy Scaho, Purvesh Sharma, Mike DeFilippo, our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.